Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. First up today on the show is our friend Adam Morrow on the phone again from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back, Adam. How are you?
Good. I'm good. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us again on the show.
My pleasure.
Turn that up there a little bit. Hey, I hear they dropped all charges against the former dictator, Hosni Mubarak. Is that so?
That is correct, yeah. All charges against Mubarak, as well as all charges against, there were several interior ministry officials, as well as his notorious former interior minister, Habib al-Adli, were all dropped. The main charge being the murder of protesters during some 800 protesters during the 2011 uprising. So yeah. So they've been exonerated of all charges until further notice. Apparently, prosecutors have said they would appeal the charge, but the sense is that that's sort of window dressing, you know, just for appearance's sake, and that these guys are probably going to walk.
Man, so then, I don't know. What's the public mood about that? It seems, you know, symbolically to be, you know, like the jackboot, crushing its heel all the way, you know, extinguishing the very last little bit of that Arab Spring from 2011 with that, huh?
Right, right. Well, yeah, that's certainly how it's been being interpreted by a lot of people here. There were protests, demonstrations, very rare now, but demonstrations nevertheless broke out in Tahrir Square. That was the day before yesterday when the verdict was announced. Reports said that three people were killed in the square when police violently broke up the protests. So it certainly elicited a reaction.
I
know for the last 48 hours, Tahrir Square has been closed for the most part, although it's been intermittently opening and closing, like they sort of don't really know what to do. The authorities don't really know what to do, because on one side, Tahrir Square has become such a symbol. They want it to be open to traffic to prove that everything is stable and normal, but at the same time they want to preempt any possible demonstrations. So for the last 48 hours we've been seeing it sort of open and shut, with the possible anticipation of future protests, but probably not. I mean, the security response now on any sort of public protest is so heavy-handed at this point that the likelihood of more demonstrations isn't too high.
Yeah. Man, so, yeah, I was going to kind of, sarcastically ask, well, why aren't there very many protests these days? And then you go on to answer, yeah, a few people were killed for daring to even show up. That's how it is. So tell us then, if you could.
Let me just say very quickly, Scott, in 2011, in the 18 days in 2011, and a lot of the demonstrations that happened after the uprising, mm-hmm. you would have police sort of taking a gradual, you know, approach, sort of starting with tear gas, then graduating to birdshot, and then graduating to heavy ammunition. Whereas now, you know, 2.5 years later, 3 years after all of that, with all of the escalation that we've seen, you now have them beginning with heavy ammunition in many cases. And in fact, they've almost come out and warned and said, you know, any sort of demonstrations, public protests will be met with live ammunition from the get-go. So this is one of the reasons why you're seeing fewer protests.
Man, so how pervasive is the atmosphere of fear then? Because it seems like back in 2011, the consensus was the entire society, everybody on the right and everybody on the left and everybody who's not an officer would like to have a devolution of power from the military dictatorship to the people here.
Right, right. Well, that was in the immediate wake of the uprising, and it did seem like that. When the regime was on the defensive and everybody was sort of scurrying under rocks and sort of taking, running for cover, basically. In the 3 years since, though, they've managed to regroup, you know, what is popularly referred to as the deep state has managed to regroup, and they weren't as unpopular as you know, as what you just described. I mean, we always come back to the 2012 election results in which Mubarak's last prime minister, Ahmed Shafiq, narrowly lost with something like 48% of the vote. So they're not, you know, this is a substantial segment of society. And this is, these aren't people like necessarily like regime loyalists. Those people have to understand these aren't people that like the regime just because for the sake of the regime. There are hundreds of thousands of people out there whose livelihoods depend on the regime because of the sprawling public sector that the government has, that this regime has built. You know, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who rely on a government paycheck at the end of every month. And if a regime falls and house cleaning starts and redundant personnel get laid off, all of those hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people stand to lose their jobs in the event of some major rotation of power. So you also have that. You also have like just a lot of government employees, hundreds of thousands of government employees who are just sort of, you know, paid into the system. You know, who have just sort of invested into the system in the sense that they're, you know, it's the system, it's the regime that's giving them their paychecks at the end of every month, and they don't want to get the axe.
Yeah.
If a new person comes in and deems them, unnecessary.
Right. So there you go. You have your answer. How do people tolerate fascism when they are forced to depend on it and they don't know how they're going to get from here to there? That's the answer.
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, or, no, I was just kind of musing out loud, I guess. The people
of
Egypt overthrew a fascist dictatorship, and now, what are you going to do?
Right, right, right.
You know, it's horrible. Don't get me wrong, it's not that the military didn't, kill better than 1,000 Muslim Brotherhood supporters after the coup and make sure that they were clear that they were not going to tolerate any kind of revolution against them anymore. That's certainly the case. So what are they going to do, really? It's not like the people of Egypt are armed or, you know, have any defense against these guys. Back in 2011, the only reason Mubarak left was because the junior officers took the side of the people in Tahrir Square instead of their senior officers. But, you know, that was pretty much
and in
one time
that
magical
that whole
sort of
operation,
influence
that
of
whole
events.
Devolution of power in 2011 looks a bit like an operation now. Looks a bit like a bit of intelligent public relations that they pulled off. Looks like a bit of a good cop, bad cop routine that they sort of did, where they were like, okay, police are bad, Mubarak is bad, he's going to step down, and now this military, this army that's like, you know, made up of your brothers and sisters and who love you so much and are out to protect the welfare of the people are going to step in and make sure everything goes okay for this interim period. And we've since learned that the military apparatus, you know, the entire military institution isn't as benign as it was originally cast to be, you know, in those heady days of 2011. So I think that was kind of a good cop, bad cop routine they sort of did, where they had the military step in and pose as the good cop, you know, these noble officers who refused to open fire on their fellow Egyptians, you know, when in fact it was the military establishment that the Mubarak was representing the whole time. So it wasn't actually a real change in power when Mubarak stepped down and handed things over to the military. You know, it was just a clever bit of window dressing that they did. And then at the end of the day, the same sort of power center still remained intact.
Well, but then again,
that's what
happened in 2011. Didn't it take the counter coup to seize the power back from the elected parliament and the elected president and the change that had really been made?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. It was a counter-revolution. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head.
The original revolution, though, wasn't just bogus. I mean, maybe the military decided then that Mubarak was expendable, and maybe they decided, well, we'll just have Sisi move in a couple years or something, but they weren't. It's not like good cop was, you know, put the Muslim Brotherhood in power on, you know, deliberately, did they?
No. I didn't mean to belittle the whole January 25th revolution as an operation. I mean, the January 25th revolution or uprising or whatever you want to call it was absolutely legitimate. I mean, I saw it unfold in front of my eyes. I mean, this was a grassroots thing that was totally people driven. But the way they handled it, they were forced into a situation where they had to sort of, they knew they had to relinquish some power.
Right.
So I think what they did was they sort of cut Mubarak loose, let him relinquish power, sort of put the blame on the police. of the ones who were the main instigators of all the, you know, of all the violence. And then that sort of mollified the people enough that people sort of bought into this whole, army as sort of benign protector of the nation. And for that reason, just and sort of ceded power to the military voluntarily until elections could be held.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sorry. We got to take this break, Adam. So please hold it right there. When we get back, everybody, we'll be talking more Egyptian politics with Adam Morrow. Mubarak, they dismissed all charges against Mubarak, his friend and successor, Sisi, has. We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Adam Morrow, a reporter for Interpress Service, or was, anyway. Yeah, we're talking about Egypt, the American-backed fascist dictatorship there of Field Marshal Fatah al-Sisi. And we're talking about the Arab Spring Revolution and its cancellation. And now kind of the ultimate insult to injury here. They're even letting Mubarak off, the former dictator, on the charges of massacring the people in Tahrir Square that were, in fact, killed. Even though the big massacre never happened, thank goodness. And so, I'm sorry, I forget exactly where we left off. It was somewhere about something about the military's reaction to the elections and the rise to power of the Muslim Brotherhood in the parliament and the presidency there, Adam.
Yeah. We were talking about also 2011 and sort of how that all went down. But I think it's important to that people realize now that this Mubarak verdict is. And just how politicized it is and how much evidence there apparently there seems to have been. Just the poor job that the prosecution did and the fact that it's on the record that, you know, high-ranking officers were tampering with evidence and were destroying evidence and this sort of thing. It's just the irregularities and the legal violations that appear to have been involved in this case. And the fact that he was exonerated anyway, the fact that all the defendants were let off for these crimes anyway, constitutes the ultimate proof that what happened a year and a half ago was a counter-revolution. This June 30th demonstration that led to this military coup, that this was not a people-driven military coup or was a popular uprising against Morsi or any of that sort of stuff. But this was a straight-up counter-revolution, which is basically putting all the same people back in power, dismantling and destroying any vestige of what had been a democratically elected electoral politics in general, real genuine electoral politics, the destruction of the only real source, the only real opposition, which was the Brotherhood, the only real organized political opposition in the country, which was the Brotherhood, and a return to the Mubarak regime, if not the actual man, then certainly the people that were running the show behind the scenes. The same people are back in command now, and will basically do anything that it takes to make sure that the January 25th thing was not replicated. Yeah. I think that's their main. Go ahead.
Tell me, why do the Saudis hate the Muslim Brotherhood so much? Is it just because they believe in standing for election and they don't want that idea to spread, or is there more to it than that?
I think it's because the Brotherhood represents the only real legitimate sort of political reform movement that has real Islamist credentials. The Saudis can always fall back on their Islamist credentials to prop up to legitimize their regime. Whereas the Brotherhood, it's a real force for political change. It's a real, it's devoted to political change. It's eschewed violence. It's not violent or fanatical. It's very moderate. And it's Islamist, It's the sort of thing. It's the sort of thing that obviously really, really scares them. Just based on their reaction to everything that's happened, it's the one force that really, really scares scares, you know, really, really scares them and makes them, you know, makes them fear for their own, which that could possibly threaten their legitimacy, I think. That if a Muslim Brotherhood type organization ever got root in Saudi Arabia, I mean, it could really stand a chance to, like, to threaten their, you know, decades long grip on power. That's what I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it's a legitimate reformist Islamist political force in the region. You're possibly the only one. You know, you've got lots of different Islamist groups. We've talked about this before, but most of them are like, you know, you've got a lot of these jihadist ones that are closely associated with violence and beheadings and this sort of thing. Whereas the Muslim Brotherhood is a totally legitimate, again, entirely political organization and a force for reform with serious Islamist credentials. And I think that was enough to really, really put the fear of God, so to speak, into the Saudi regime. And they really saw it as a threat, to the point where they not only did they have to destroy it in Egypt, but they are now going after the Brotherhood globally. They are now trying to discredit it in the UK, trying to say that it's a terrorist organization.
Well, and at the same time, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how they say they want to support the moderate Sunni Islamists in Syria,
right,
which would be the Muslim Brotherhood, right? But then here's the, you know, the guys that they just overthrew in Egypt. Here's a quote from Loretta Napoleoni's new book that I'm reading, The Islamist Phoenix, about the Islamic State. And this could, you know, is ripped straight out of your and my interviews from a few years back about what could happen here. And it's this guy loyal to Baghdadi saying, look at Egypt. Look at the way it ended for Muslims who cast their vote for the deposed President Mohamed Morsi and believed in your democracy, in your lies. Democracy doesn't exist. Do you think you're free? This is a message that he's saying, mocking and trying to recruit Muslims living in the West and saying, oh yeah, this is how much the Americans believe in democracy. This is how much power you'll ever have if you participate in the game, as much as the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt have in their graves and in their prison cells. So just making,
right,
again, it's just like Ayman al-Zawahiri had been railing against the Muslim Brotherhood for years for even wanting to stand in an election. Then they stood in a couple, won them, and had them canceled, which just proves Zawahiri right, which just proves Baghdadi right, at least on the question of whether the Western powers mean what they say about democratic power, or whether, you know, they just want loyal sock puppets. I mean, just look at the reality. How is that deniable to some, you know, I don't know, Egyptian or Jordanian or Saudi citizen in his 20s looking at this, you know, recent history and the way the Americans and their allies behave there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've spoken about this before, and I agree wholeheartedly that it's a huge strategic mistake to put this message out, to go after, to basically, you've got this moderate force, like you said before, you've got this moderate Islamist force that's eschewed violence and has reiterated its commitment to the purely political for decades, and then to suddenly when they actually perform well in elections and actually get their hands on the reins of power, to then go after them, destroy them, and accuse them of being terrorists and doing all this terrorist stuff that they never even did, is a recipe for disaster. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if young Muslims in the region of Islamist tendencies learned those lessons. But that's kind of the thing but that's kind of exactly what Sisi and company want. See, they don't want these guys to be, they don't want these guys to be politically minded, and they don't want them to operate purely in the realm of electoral politics. Why? Because they'll win elections. They know that. These rulers,
so they
know
want them
that
to marginalize themselves by resorting
so
to terrorism.
So it's better to enter into this existential, zero sum battle with them and make it this like military versus Muslim terrorists, you know, this sort of neoconservative fantasy of perpetual war between these two camps, rather than have any sort of meaningful political or electoral competition.
Right.
Why?
Because I'm sorry, we're out of time, Adam. We got to go,
but they'll win. Sure.
Right. Thanks again. Good talk to you again soon.
Take care, Scott.
We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com.
Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.